8:08 on your Wednesday afternoon. Raj Taylor driving you home. And joining us now, Dan O'Neill. He is one of the people coordinating the Traverse City Conference on Michigan Election Reform. And hi, Dan. How you doing?
I'm good, Roger. Thanks for having me.
Let me read you a quote, and then you talk to me about I found this appalling. Talk to me about if this is one of the reasons you're meeting. During the last election cycle, 3/4 of the money that was spent on the Supreme Court election could not be traced. Is that accurate?
As far as we know, it's accurate. Rich Robinson, as you know, who will be a speaker at our conference on October 11th up here in Traverse City, does a lot of research on those kinds of issues, and that's his belief, and I tend to believe him. You know, I mean, that certainly is a problem and a major problem, and campaigns and the money in campaigns that relate to judicial races are sort of a special problem on their own. And we have a system where a judge ought not to hear a case if he or she has a bias or a conflict of interest.
I think they call that recusing themselves.
That's what they should do. But when the vast majority of the money that's spent to elect judges to office is unreported, we have no way of knowing when we stand in front of a judge whether the person on the other side of the courtroom has contributed to the judge's campaign or not.
Mm-hmm.
And not having that knowledge, I think, is really bad for the Michigan court system.
Are there any other states that go through the charade of pretending that elections for Supreme Court justices are not political, and yet the nominees for running are generated by the political parties, but then we pretend that all of a sudden they become pure and white and unrelated to politics once they're nominated? Are there any other states that go through foolishness like that?
Well, you know, almost all states are different in how they select judges, particularly to the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals. I don't know whether there are other states that follow Michigan's process of having candidates for the Supreme Court nominated at the party conventions and then run on a nonpartisan ballot.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there are things, lots of things that can be done to make the system better, but it's hard to come up with a solution that fixes all the problems. Some states appoint the judges, and while that would, you know, eliminate some of the problems related to the massive amount of money that is spent on these races, you know, political appointments tend to be political by their very nature.
You think?
And so it's tough to wring the politics out of the courts. But, you know, it is so important for people to have confidence in their government and most importantly in their courts, and to know that everybody stands equal before the law. And when you have a system where millions and millions of dollars, much of it coming from outside the state of Michigan, are spent on the campaigns for the folks who make really, really important decisions that affect all of us every day on that Supreme Court, it's difficult not to cry out for change.
The conference that you're heading up is it's an umbrella of organizations: the Michigan Campaign Finance Network, the Michigan Center for Election Law, and Common Cause. How did three organizations come to cooperate in this one conference?
Well, I've been working on these issues for a while now. This started, I did some work 2 years ago on the Supreme Court races. I had put together a program, went around, talked to folks about how important those Supreme Court races were,
mm-hmm.
where the money comes from, and the kind of decisions that we've been getting from the Michigan Supreme Court. And in that process, it sort of ran into a lot of people who were also very concerned about this issue. You may recall that Jocelyn Benson had started an initiative for transparency and disclosure
mm-hmm.
Several years ago.
Yeah.
And I worked with Jocelyn on that. And, you know, her plate has become very, very full in that she's now the dean of the law school at Wayne State University and,
right.
and does all sorts of other things. And she had asked whether I'd be willing to sort of pick up where she left off on that issue. Although I don't pretend to be able to be anywhere near as effective as Jocelyn is at these issues, I agreed to give it a try, and this conference is an outgrowth of that. But in addition to Common Cause and the other organizations who are sponsoring the conference, we'll also have representatives here to talk about the issue from a number of organizations, not just Common Cause and the Election Coalition, but we'll have folks from labor. We'll have folks from the trial lawyers. We'll have several legislators here. Mark Meadows will be here. Jeff Irwin, Jim Townsend from Royal Oak will be here to talk to us. We'll have Melanie McElroy from Common Cause, Jane Bailey from the trial lawyers, Libby McGaughey from America Votes. And then we'll have retired Supreme Court Justices Alton Tom Davis, Betty Weaver, and a former Supreme Court Justice, and a retired member of the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals,
mm-hmm.
Judge Ryan. So the hope is that we are going to get under one roof, not only in terms of the panelists, all sorts of different views, but also bring to the conference as attendees folks who are interested in this issue and who are willing to work on it, and then we can come away with sort of a common direction and a common set of goals.
We're talking with Dan O'Neill with the Traverse City Conference on Michigan election reform. A couple of years ago, I read a study that looked at Supreme Courts in all the states across the country. And I believe it was done by the University of Chicago Law School, but it's a couple of years ago. And
that's right.
I may be wrong on who did the study. But Michigan was ranked at near the bottom as far as quality of decisions coming out of Supreme Courts. Do you recall that? And have you seen anything that infers we're making any progress in improving the quality of our Supreme Court decisions?
I do remember the study, and you're right, it was from the University of Chicago, and that study looked at a couple of things, and you're right, the Michigan Supreme Court was at the bottom. And it looked at a couple of things. One is that it looked at what it determined to be how political the court was, how often the decisions of the court were split along party lines. Typically, you know, even though you have members of a court on a Supreme Court from different parties, they ought to agree on basic elements of the law more often than not. And in Michigan, that doesn't happen. So our court was the most political in the nation. And in addition to that, they looked at how often other states looked to Michigan Supreme Court for guidance on the law and found that other states almost never look to Michigan courts for guidance on the law, because the way we interpret the law is so different from other states, and that the Michigan court quotes and looks to other states for guidance on the law very, very rarely. And that's because the way we interpret the law is, again, out of step with what's happening in other states.
And
those three factors...
Go ahead.
Those three factors resulted in the Michigan Supreme Court being ranked very, very low, if not at the bottom.
So out of this conference that's coming up, and before we go any further, what are the specific dates of the conference?
The conference is going to be held on Friday, October the 11th, at the Holiday Inn in Traverse City.
Okay.
It's a one-day conference.
Okay. Do you see anything coming out of this conference that would be sort of a work plan to deal with some of the criticisms of the Michigan Supreme Court?
Well, we hope so. You know, there are a number of proposals for changing the way that we elect and or appoint members of the Michigan Supreme Court. And retired Justice Betty Weaver wrote a book and outlined in it a plan that she's putting forward for changing how we do Supreme Court elections. And former Justice Marilyn Kelly, along with Justice Ryan, who will be at the conference, also put out a plan for changing the way we elect justices to the Michigan Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
And so there will be lots of talk about that. In addition to that, there's going to be a lot of discussion about transparency and disclosure. You know, the idea that the folks who are sitting on the bench, we have no idea who spent the money to put them there.
Mm-hmm.
It's just unacceptable. And so if nothing else, we need to work. If we can't change the way they're financed and the way they're selected, the very least we ought to be able to do is let the public know who's spending the money to put them there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be a big issue that I think we'll talk a lot about at this conference.
Sure. Who is the target audience for the conference? Who are you looking for to attend?
Well, we'd like to have anyone who's interested in this issue and wants to work on it come to the conference, because the idea here, it will be educational, certainly, but we also want folks who want to work on this issue to have a sense of who the players are and what various organizations are willing to do and what sort of plans are acceptable to various organizations as we move forward. We're going to have Ian Vandewalker here from the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University Law School,
mm-hmm.
Who headed up the campaign in New York for campaign finance reform. The New York City has really a very innovative campaign finance system called Small Donor Matching Program, in which there's public financing for campaigns, but based only on matching small donations that candidates receive. So in New York City, if you receive a contribution for your campaign of $175 or less, the city matches that donation 6-1.
Mm-hmm.
They've tried to enact the same kind of program statewide and came very, very close this spring to doing that. They're confident that they may be able to accomplish it in the next legislative session. Ian will be here to talk about how they built the coalition to get that before the legislature, and about that program in particular, and I'm really excited about that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Now, this conference is coming up 2 weeks from this coming Friday.
That's right.
And if people want to learn more about it, where would they go to accomplish that?
There is a website that describes the conference. It's at MichiganElectionReform.org. And all the information about the speakers who will be there, the conference schedule, is all located on the website. And the hotel where we're holding the conference also has some reduced room rates for folks downstate who want to come up and visit. And, you know, Traverse City's beautiful this time of year.
Yeah, yeah. It's
nothing
not
better than fall in Traverse City.
Yeah, it's not exactly a horrible place to to start a weekend.
Right.
Dan, would you be willing to come back the week following the conference and give us sort of an overview of what was accomplished and what the sense of direction is following the conference?
Absolutely. It'd be my pleasure.
And do you see an ongoing coordination between the various groups that brought this conference together? Will their cooperative effort continue after this conference, or was this just a one-time thing?
No, we certainly hope that the groups that are at the conference will continue to cooperate as we move forward. That's one of the purposes of the conference. And quite frankly, we'll have a very difficult time accomplishing anything if we don't. If we don't come to some consensus as to where we go and how we get there, it's difficult to see a way forward. So that's certainly a part of the purpose of the conference is to get all these folks together and get everybody moving in one direction.
That's great. I appreciate your taking time to talk with us this afternoon, Dan. Before I let you go, tell people one more time where they might learn more about the Traverse City Conference on Michigan Election Reform.
Go to MichiganElectionReform.org.
Thanks, Dan. Have a good afternoon.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
You betcha.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Dan O'Neill, coordinating the conference in Traverse City on reforming elections in Michigan. Three-quarters of the money that was spent in the Supreme Court election is anonymous. Three-quarters of the money. We have no idea who's trying to buy favor of our Supreme Court justices. That doesn't pass a smell test. I do not like them in a house. I do not like them with a mouse. I do not like them here or there. I do not like them anywhere. I do not like green eggs and ham. I do not like them, Sam I Am. You know, I just can't do it with the flair that Ted Cruz does. I'm going to start a filibuster later today, a fake filibuster. I learned about fake filibusters from Ted Cruz, but I just don't have the flair for dramatic readings of Dr. Seuss that Senator Cruz does. I've got to keep working on that. Coming up in the next half hour, we're going to talk to Ellen Lipton. She's a representative from the Detroit area, and we're going to be talking to her about why she has had to pay thousands of dollars out of her own pocket for making Freedom of Information Act requests that should have been provided to a duly elected state legislature, legislator, simply because she asked for them. And she and another senator, Hoon Young Hopgood from Taylor, through their FOIA requests, were then given 2,000 pages of what amounts to a data dump intended to overwhelm them when they wanted to look at how effective the EEA is, the Educational Achievement Authority. And we're going to find out from her why she had to make Freedom of Information Act requests and pay thousands of dollars to get information that should have been provided to any legislator who just asks for the data. I mean, that's just doing a legislator's due diligence to look at information like that. And we'll find out why it cost her thousands of dollars out of her pocket. Coming up in the next half hour, right here on 590 WKZO. Raj Taylor taking you home this afternoon. The WKZO.com AccuWeather forecast brought to you by Asthma Allergy Centers of Southwest Michigan. For the office nearest you, visit asthmaallergycenters.com. We'll see some times of clouds, but mostly sunny and pleasant this afternoon, 72 the expected high. Clear tonight, 46 the low, mostly sunny, warmer tomorrow and again on Friday, 76 tomorrow, 79 on Friday. We've got 71 degrees for you on your way home this afternoon. And joining me now, and she is a representative from Huntington Woods in the Detroit area, is Representative Ellen Lipton. Ellen, good afternoon. How are you? Oh, here we go. Here we go. Can you hear me now?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes. I think we got this working.
Excellent.
Well, let me start with the question. I read that you have had to shell out thousands of dollars from your pocket to make Freedom of Information Act requests to get information that it would seem it would be a reasonable request from a duly elected legislator. How is it you have to spend your money and make Freedom of Information Act requests to get to do the due diligence you need in your job?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I asked the questions in committee because all of this came about when we were debating the EAA expansion bills in the House. And we asked questions in committee of the chancellor of the EAA, and the questions were, I felt, rather basic. You know, why should we expand? You know, can you confirm the things that you're saying about student achievement, student safety? And the answers that we got from the EAA was, just trust us. And so my response then was, well, would you be willing to come back and, you know, answer further questions? And the response was no. You know, he's answered the question. So my next thought was, well, okay, let me try to reconstruct some of the information that I'm looking for through documents. And you would think that, you know, when I made the request, I indicated that I'm an elected official and that, you know, I'm doing it in conjunction with the pending bill. I want to make it available to the public because there's a public interest designation that the body from which you're requesting documents can waive fees and costs if the information is in the public interest. So I stated that in my request.
Sure.
To the public. That was denied. I think they thought maybe that, you know, they could just ignore the request at that point. And I called them up and said, you know, okay, I understand you've denied my request and we'll deal with that later. But I still want the documents. And, you know, I don't care. You know, you can put up whatever roadblocks you want, but I'm going to get those documents. And so they said, you know, this is what it's going to cost you. And I didn't want any issue of, you know, what monies I should be using or what have you. And so, you know, I said, okay, I will, since I'm the requester, I am going to pay for it myself.
Okay.
But I want the documents. And so after some wrangling, they sent me, they did sort of a data dump. It took me some time to actually organize the documents, you know, what have you, but I finally did and put them up on a public website so that people can, have a look at the documents themselves. There's a lot there, but my thought was more eyes, more people that, that are watching the process will be better. And, you know, I just didn't want the issue of, you know, I didn't want to be waiting for documents. You know, I mean, that was really, to me, it was more important to give them what they wanted in terms of money so that I could get the documents first and foremost. So that was sort of what was happening.
It's interesting that they told you to just trust us, because I believe it was a fairly important conservative leader named Reagan who said something about trust but verify.
That's true. You know, I mean, I've you know, taken the position that if they have, if they found the magic bullet, you know, I mean, if they have found the answer to struggling schools, then you would think that you would want to shout that from on high.
Yeah.
This is how we did it. This is what we've done. And instead, what I'm finding is that what they're saying and what they're doing, and ultimately the problems and the harm they're creating to children, are, you know, there's a huge disconnect between the rhetoric and what's really happening on the ground. And the documents, as I'm piecing them together, are really showing that.
Have you had enough time with the documents to begin to have a feel for what's going on out there in the real world? Are you finding any reasons why they would have been reticent to give you this information?
Yes, absolutely. You know, as we're piecing it together, and I will say, you know, the more people that are looking, it's posted everything to a website inside the EAA. The more people are looking, it's really been a group effort. But there's certain threads that we've been able to see. I think probably the one that was the most concerning, and is still the most concerning, is the handling of special education students. The numbers show that a significant number of students that should have had IEPs, individual education plans, mm-hmm. When the schools were taken over by the EAA, they don't seem to be there. And when we asked what happened to these students, what is the reason for the mismatch in the numbers and the counts?
Mm-hmm.
And the response was, we retested them. And when I asked in my document request, you know, evidence of IEP committees, they produce nothing. And having talked to experts in the field, the law does not allow you to. There's no test that you can give that. You know, one day a student that had an IEP should not have an IEP. I mean, there are ways of rewriting and changing an IEP, but it's a process you have to go through, and it appears that was not the case. It didn't happen, and the documents have showed that. And anecdotally, I'm hearing on a fairly consistent basis students and their families that are being denied services. Services that they had been getting, and now that they're in the EAA school, they're not getting those services. There seems to be, so that's sort of one thread. There's another thread of information, very, very disconcerting, is the number of teachers either without proper certification or very, very junior teachers. What we're seeing from the data is that the teachers that they brought in, there's a requirement that teachers be given a mid-year and end-of-year evaluation so that they can figure out what's working, what's not working, you know, getting feedback, what have you. And those evaluations didn't occur, or they were given by people that had never observed the teachers. So what happened at the end of the year was this sort of chaotic, where in June and July, teachers didn't know if they were coming back the following year, creating a lot of chaos in a situation where you really want consistency and stability for those students.
Yeah. Well,
so that was another whole issue that documents showed. And anyway, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No. I was going to say conservatives frequently talk about uncertainty being a huge problem for the business world, yet it's not a problem for schools. Those teachers who didn't know if they were going to be called back, that kind of uncertainty isn't a problem. Other uncertainties are problems. We're talking with Ellen Lipton, representative from Huntington Woods. Do any of the problems that you're seeing rise to violations of law, or are these just mismanagement and doing a poor job? Do any of these concerns rise to breaking the law?
They do, and I'll just outline three in particular that the documents have shown. Now, on the special education front, state and federal law requires there needs to be a plan when you open a new school. There is a plan there in place for your special education population. And what I learned, again, through the document request, is that the EAA opened its doors, and there was not a plan in place. The explanation is that, well, we don't know what we are. Are we a district? We're not an ISD. We don't know what we are. The law does not excuse that. You can be whatever you want to call yourself, but if you are going to accept special ed students, the law says you must have a plan. Mm-hmm. They did not have a plan. Okay, the department has acknowledged. Everyone has acknowledged they didn't have a plan. They're trying to scramble together a plan. Guess what? The EAA, those schools were, this is now the second year. And there were kids with special education needs that have been denied services because of what they've done. So that is of enormous concern. I have filed a systemic complaint outlining a number of areas where both state and federal law was not followed in terms of IEPs either being rewritten or not being followed, and the department is refusing to investigate the systemic complaint. I have provided documentation, and their response is, we're not going to investigate because you have not given us, we want more. We want more information. What you've given us isn't enough, you know, and I'm thinking, even any one of the allegations should be enough.
Right.
So that's one area. Number two, the issue of under the Teacher Tenure Act, we acknowledge and understand that these are teachers that were hired at will employees, but the law governing the Teacher Tenure Act governs regardless of your status, organized or not.
Mm-hmm.
And those basic due process protections that, you know, provide stability in a schoolroom, those were not followed. In simple requirements, a written evaluation at mid-year, given by someone who actually observed the teacher, and then a final year evaluation. But it simply wasn't followed.
Mm-hmm.
Just discarded out the door. And then lastly, we found through the FOIA request that the chancellor, the EAA made an application for a federal grant, $35 million federal grant, and stated under penalty of perjury in this federal grant application that the EAA was operating in school districts across the state. Southfield, Grand Rapids, I believe Kalamazoo, I mean a whole number of school districts, and that was a false.
Interesting.
Now the response was, well, that's what we intended and it was an innocent mistake.
Mm-hmm.
That's concerning.
Yeah. Misrepresentation is misrepresentation. What gives people the idea that this program is ready to expand? What you're suggesting, what we're doing now is questionable. But where do people get the idea that this program is ready to take additional school districts under its arms?
You know, I've oftentimes thought that, you know, I mean, because what we heard in committee was, well, you know, just stop being so critical. You know, all you naysayers, just stop being so critical. You know, at least we're doing something. But my feeling is, you know, look, I go to the doctor for a hangnail, okay, and the doctor lops off my finger, okay? It's not appropriate to say, at least I did something. If the something that you're doing is more harmful than the problem you're trying to solve, you are doing harm. And so, you know, that seems to be the response that we keep getting is, well, you know, at least give us a chance. You know, just trust us, and at least we're doing something. And that is, in my mind, absolutely no reason to, you know, double down on an experiment that, at least in its, you know, where we are now, I mean, it's not like it opened, you know, the EAA opened yesterday. I mean, we now have a year of information under our belt. And on pretty much every data point we would want to look at, student safety, handling of special education, finances are in shambles. They're failing. So, you know, other than the fact that there are some people that say, you know, we're if you look at their brochures and their commercials, you know, boy, it looks like they're just the greatest thing since sliced bread. But you sort of, you know, you pull away the curtain and you realize now things are not so good.
If people want to look at this information that you collected, could you point them to that website one more time?
Sure. It's inside the EAA. So all one word, inside the EAA.com. And as information, you know, the FOIA requests, the documents, they're up there. And I've interfaced with a program that allows them to be searched by keyword. And so that's made it a little bit more accessible. But I have been hearing from people that they would like some further organization in terms of could I put the documents in subcategories. So I am working as fast as I can to try to do that as well.
Thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us this afternoon.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
We were talking to Representative Ellen Lipton, a Michigan State representative. That's going to do it for me this afternoon. Kalamazoo's Evening News is next, the 5 o'clock news hour, right here on 590 WKZO.
This is Kalamazoo's news station and Kalamazoo's home for Detroit Tiger baseball. 590 WKZO, Kalamazoo.